Welcome to the program for Friday, September 28, 2012, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's a Federal News Countdown with the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by two people who are experts in the world of the federal government. And this week, my experts include Bob Suda of Suda & Associates and a veteran of GSA, the Agriculture Department, Transportation, all over the map you've been, and it's great to have you in the studio with me, and good to see you again, my friend.
Same here, Francis.
And Alan Shvatkin is Executive Vice President of the Professional Services Council and also a veteran of the Countdown. It's good to see you.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you for coming in today. We start this week with the third most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Alan Shvatkin, and the headline is White House Testing Approach Called For in draft cyber order. And this is my colleague Jason Miller's story on federalnewsradio.com. This has generated a whole lot of hubbub, just the idea that the White House will try to do through executive order what Congress was unable or unwilling to do through legislation, Alan.
And absolutely, and that's why I selected the story, notwithstanding Jason's writing it. The cybersecurity is probably the number one issue that, other than budget, that everybody's talking about. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has called it the number one national security issue. It is the new fifth domain in the Defense Department's strategy. And we can't seem to have a federal government come together around policy, whether it be legislative or regulatory. This Professional Services Council has been working hard with both the executive branch and the Congress in trying to develop some policies that many of our companies are on the selling side, but almost all of our companies are potential targets, and you work in the federal space, you're at risk. And so having the federal, a clear set of policies and guidelines from the federal government is important, whether that comes from the executive branch or Congress is of no real difference to us. We just need the guidance.
The idea that the and that seems to be the crux of where the conversation's been is this the right thing for the executive branch to do, or should this come from Congress? But to be fair, Congress has been batting this around. This is at least the third year, I think, that there's been some kind of cyber legislation that's gone back and forth and back and forth between House and Senate and within the individual sides of the Hill.
That's right, and there's a wide range of interest and attentions, and cybersecurity is no more a finite set of discussions. It covers everything from information coverage to liability protection to response and recovery. So everybody's got a different perspective, often on the Congress, where they stand in their committees of jurisdiction depends on where they sit on the issues of cyber. We've laid out a couple of standards that parameters that we think are important, bi-directional, information sharing from government to industry, from industry to government, some clear liability protection, and a set of standards that will vary by industry so that companies in the defense sector or companies in the electric utility sector will know what's going on. As Jason pointed out here, there's already a lot going on administratively. Ongoing work that Homeland Security has been the leader of, some in the Defense Department. We can build on that. The point here is we need to start making decisions and taking actions, minimize the conversations.
You know what's really fascinated me, Alan, since this story first broke that the White House was putting this language together, is it's generated a lot of conversation about the fact that, hey, not only should Congress be looking at cybersecurity legislation, but maybe it's time to go back and really do a redo on FISMA, maybe the eGov Act, and maybe even Clinger-Cohen, and really revise these things for today's technology, for where the government is today. Some of these things, Mark Forman was on the program yesterday and said, I'm paraphrasing him, that Clinger-Cohen is sufficiently old enough that cybersecurity is not really even an element there because we weren't thinking about that networks in that way then.
And FISMA is a component of some of the legislative initiatives in the Congress. There's been some work in the executive branch. Stephen Rocco's been doing quite a bit in those areas. It's all been piecemeal. There's a White House cyber coordinator. We would hope that there'd be greater coordination and greater progress made on some of those areas. We hope that we're still ahead of a curve. We know that there's intrusions. We know that there's damage taking place, being inflicted inflicted. We hope it's nothing catastrophic before we solve this problem.
Alan Shvatkin's third most important federal news story of the week from the federalnewsradio.com. My colleague Jason Miller, the headline is White House testing approach called for in draft cyber order. And all the stories in the countdown this week are linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Bob, your third most important federal news story of the week is from GovLoop. The headline is, what would you do if you were in charge of RFPEZ? Now, explain that before we move ahead and you tell me why you think this is a big deal.
Well, I think it's a big deal because we've been fighting the whole issue of getting procurements out the door quicker, whether it's, you know, best value versus lower price. I think the opportunity here of having people come in that don't have any baggage with them, so there's no restrictions on regulation or legislation, and then come up with some ideas that we can maybe move forward down a path that we can now change legislation or regulation in order to do something. It isn't about the technology of what we have available here. It's about how do we change what we've done for the last 35 to 40 years. You look at the FAR. I mean, how far does that go back? No pun intended. But the bottom line is that.
But I see what you did there. I like
right.
that.
Things have changed. I mean, things in buying technology, buying infrastructure today, buying security. How do we partner with our commercial sector a lot better? We haven't looked at other ways of buying. So I think bringing in fellows that have no baggage to look at things, look at opportunities. I mean, when I was up running Volpe up in Boston, I had MIT, Harvard, and Brown at my disposal. So I would bring those graduate students in to work on projects. And they had no deal with the regulations. Then we would wrap the regulations around those projects to see if they fit or didn't fit. And we would then try to change those things.
It's a different worldview. Because here in Washington, we tend to think, what are the policies, what are the procedures that we have to have in place first before we can move out on the solutions? And it sounds like you're saying a different mindset yields potentially different results.
Most definitely. I think, you know, one opportunity I don't think we've really tapped yet is, you know, we have Steve Kelm up in Harvard. He has a whole, basically, curriculum around procurement. Why don't we use some of the fellows that are up there and some of the, you know, the grad students that are up there to develop some of these things and look at the FAR, look at the policies that we have in place today for procurement? Because every time, you know, sitting on this side of the fence now versus on the government side, it is tough for industry out there to get things done from a procurement standpoint. They don't know where they stand on a procurement when it goes out. They don't know when it's going to be awarded. I mean, there's still that closed mindset a lot of times by procurement officials. And I can understand at a certain point, but we've talked about the Mythbusters. We've talked about a number of different things around procurement. I think this is one. It's a start. Okay, it's something to look at.
Clay Johnson is the RFPEZ Presidential Innovation Fellow, and this story deals with some of the issues that he is working on as he proceeds through this fellowship and works on this particular issue. What is it about this that makes you think that this is a good start? Because we've seen stops and starts and stops and starts in trying to make the overall acquisition process easier, what, 30,000 times over the past however long?
It comes back to if Clay Johnson has the power to get it within OMB and to be able to move this forward and get OMB out of the way. Okay, so OFPP, Joe Jordan, those guys, have got to embrace this. And they've got to make sure government embraces this. The problem we've had in the past is that we've had so many initiatives going on at one time in the procurement arena that the procurement officials themselves cannot get out of their own way. They can't even do procurements because you have all these other things going on, whether it had been the change of best value or the things around quality assurance and things like that. It was all this additional things they had to put in place. I think that there's got to be a limited amount of new things coming out. And this may be the right start.
Bob Suda's third most important federal news story of the week is from GovLoop. The headline is, what would you do if you were in charge of RFPEZ? And you can read about it linked up now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Back to count down the second most important federal news stories of the week from Bob Suda and Alan Shvatkin when In-Depth with Francis Rose continues in just a moment.
Most organizations are keenly aware of threats to their cybersecurity perpetrated by malicious insiders. But recently, the internal threat has morphed. More than ever, accidental insiders, individuals who aren't deliberately trying to cause harm, can unknowingly expose an organization and its infrastructure to major risks. How prevalent are these accidental insider threats? What vulnerabilities can they cause? How does legislation and policy affect what organizations can do to mitigate these risks? Listen to The Accidental Insider Threat. Is your organization ready? As part of the Expert Voices panel series, sponsored by Booz Allen Hamilton, featuring top industry experts and leaders. Tuesday, October 2nd at 12 noon on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. For more information, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword Booz Allen, or visit the Expert Voices website at boozallen.com/expertvoices.
Let's play a quick game. I say salt. You might say pepper. What about Kaiser Permanente? I'll wait. Still waiting. Did anybody say advanced technology? It's true. We have the world's largest private electronic medical record system. It's how our doctors know instantly if you're overdue for tests or life-saving screenings, which means our members get fast, convenient, high-quality care. What about top doctors? That's true, too. Many of our doctors come from schools such as Harvard, Stanford, and Johns Hopkins, just to name a few. And how about highest ranked? As in J.D. Power and Associates ranked Kaiser Permanente highest in member satisfaction among commercial health plans in the Virginia, Maryland, and D.C. region 4 years in a row. Of course, if you did say any of those things, then, well, you're probably already a member. Not a member yet? Learn more at kp.org/MidAtlantic. Kaiser Permanente. Thrive.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852. For J.D. Power and Associates award information, go to jdpower.com.
The next generation of iPhone is going to support near-field communications. The Android already does. It's a protocol where you can just hold your phone up close to a device at the store, and you can make a payment without even bringing out your credit card. All your credit card information is in your cell phone. You just go there. You see something comes on your cell phone, the dollar amount, and you approve it, and bingo, you pay. So it's going to be the end of credit cards with this near-field communications.
Stay up to date with technology. It's Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
What are the top federal financial management priorities? How does the Office of Management and Budget work to implement these priorities? And how is OMB working to transform the way government does business? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and much more with Danny Werfel, Controller of the Office of Financial Management, OFFM, within OMB. That's next week on the Business of Government Hour.
Tom Temin here with a preview of Monday's Federal Drive. The government's international cooperation efforts don't just take place here on Earth. We'll find out what's going on with a commerce program to share satellites in space, plus a new fiscal year, and we'll have the latest outlook for federal employees from Susan Grundman, chairman of the Merit Systems Protection Board. Those stories and more Monday morning, starting at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Bob Suda and Alan Schvatkin. And we are up to, on the countdown,
number two.
Second most important federal news story of the week from Alan Schvatkin is from GovExec. The headline is White House to Government Contractors Stop Human Trafficking. Now, human trafficking, you'll have to admit, Alan, is not a story. I don't think we've ever had a story about human trafficking on the Federal News Countdown before. It's certainly important. It's certainly horrible. And I'm wondering why you think this is something that's really noteworthy.
Well, there's a couple of reasons. It is abhorrent. I hope there's never you never have another reason to talk about it. I've selected the story for a couple of reasons. This is another example of the balance between White House action and congressional action. So the president taking action to issue an executive order on anti-trafficking steps. Congress has been considering legislation for quite a while. Some current legislation's already expired almost a year ago, not been enacted. The presumption, this executive order covers contractors only. The presumption being that that universe of actors are bad actors or risk. The evidence isn't that. But again, we show impose a compliance burden on those who are trying to comply large segments of the population that are probably greater risk not covered by the actions. So we've raised the barrier to entry, we've increased the burden on those who are in the system, and we'll keep more and more companies out. Bad behavior, we want to stop human trafficking, there may be other ways to go after it.
This story says this policy will seek to strengthen existing laws against government contracts going to companies involved in human trafficking by requiring contractors to provide more information about their foreign employees. It requires a compliance plan from any contractor or subcontractor whose foreign services exceed $500,000. Who manages this, Alan, and how do they do it, I guess, is my next question.
Well, we've had regulations for a number of years in the Federal Acquisition Regulation governing human trafficking. It's primarily a burden that's imposed on the administrative contracting officer in the Defense Department. That's the Defense Contract Management Agency, primarily, that's got to supervise it. Many of those administrative contracting officers are no more well-versed in trafficking issues than other areas of labor relations or legal matters. And so we've taken some issue with the concept that companies are engaging in human trafficking. Yes, we may be at a greater exposure to that risk because of the nature of the work and where that work is being done. But again, it is the compliance burden being imposed on those who are in the best position, domestic U.S. companies working for the U.S. government who are trying to prevent it and not engage in it.
Bob, that compliance burden is something that, of course, goes to the bottom line. If it costs more for a company to comply with what the government requires of them, they're going to charge the government for that. And understanding that part of it is what I wonder sometimes, not about this particular policy, but I wonder how much account is taken in on that particular issue when various regulations regarding contracts come down the pike.
Well, again, sitting on this side of the fence now, I mean, it's a burden on companies that actually do this. I mean, sometimes, you know, procurement officials or program managers inside government just want to get the lowest price. Well, with all the compliance issues that are a burden, right, to a lot of companies out there, there's got to be an increase in overhead. So somebody's got to pay those rates somehow or some way. And I don't think we as government officials worry about that kind of stuff. They still want the lowest price ever. But what happens is that they may get the lowest price, but then 6 months later, they've got to either issue a cure notice or they've got to do something with that contract because they can't perform because they've put the prices so low they can't do it. So compliance is a real issue. The procurement officials, though, are going to have responsibility in this, too. If this goes through, the whole human trafficking thing, is that they have to now manage that company's either subcontractors or contractors who are doing work outside of the U.S. a lot closer than they have in the past.
And that's the part of it that's why I asked Alan, who keeps track of all this? Because if you're the sub, do you report directly to the contracting agency, or as he used the example of DCMA, mm-hmm. or do you report to your prime, and the prime reports all the information for all their subs? And structurally, I'm sure all of that stuff is covered in the executive order, but there's so many potential layers there.
Right.
Is it the layers? Is it the compliance issues, Alan? Is it the, I mean, because if you look at the surface of this, the goal of it is entirely noble and entirely in keeping with the values of the United States of America.
Yes, and we share those. We absolutely share those. And so the challenge here is, I mean, if we knew the companies that were involved in human trafficking, it'd be easy to say, don't do business with them.
Sure.
Instead of trying to identify those and adopting that kind of policy, we've layered a compliance regime on the entire acquisition, on all the companies doing work over whatever the thresholds are. Legislation's a little different than the executive order, to self-report, to check on that, and that's the burden that I'm talking about, that for companies that have every interest in complying and stopping trafficking. We fully support other initiatives that the executive branch has, greater training, greater resources for law enforcement, catch the bad actors, hold them accountable, all fully supportive from our perspective and our member companies.
The other challenge, though, Alan, is also now the IG gets involved, right? So if the compliance is not being done properly, then the IG's got to look at the compliance inside government as well as the compliance of the contractor.
And so, now you're no longer talking about trafficking. Now you're talking about contract compliance.
Right.
The very different kinds of very different regime than trying to stop trafficking. Mm-hmm. So I hope you never have another story on it. I hope I'm wrong about what the implications are here. But again, this is the one that puts Congress and the executive branch, the president, in a little bit of a tussle. Many of the members of Congress have raised that question, saying the president's action will actually undercut legislation. There's some things here, just like in cyber, that the president cannot do administratively. We'll continue to watch, and fortunately we've been engaged in many of those discussions.
Alan Fotkin's second most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec. The headline is White House to Government Contractors Stop Human Trafficking, and you can read it and all the stories we're counting down at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Bob Suda's second most important federal news story of the week when In Depth with Francis Rose continues on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The March of Dimes and AFSCME Nova will honor women in the technology industry who are making a difference in their communities at the 12th annual Heroines in Technology Gala. From CEOs to government executives and young professionals, these women exemplify leadership and volunteerism in their communities. This year's awards program is sponsored by Intel, and finalists will be recognized for their significant contributions at this black tie event, Friday, November 9th at the Hilton McLean in Tyson's Corner. All proceeds from Heroines in Technology will benefit the March of Dimes and its fight to prevent birth defects, premature birth, and infant mortality. Since 2001, this event's raised more than $1.4 million to support the March of Dimes' mission. For more information about the March of Dimes or to learn more about Heroines in Technology, visit marchofdimes.com/metroDC. That's marchofdimes.com/metroDC.
And now the Federal Living Report, brought to you by WEPA.
Healthcare premiums for federal employees are going up in 2013. Feds covered by the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program will see an average increase of 3.4%, according to the Office of Personnel Management. Premiums for the Federal Employees Dental and Vision Insurance Program will increase by less than 1%. Feds will be given the chance to update their health plans during this year's open season, which runs from November 12th to December 10th.
WEPA, a nonprofit association, has just announced another 25% premium refund. Since 1996, WEPA policyholders have received 16 annual premium refunds totaling over $65 million. WEPA also offers life insurance at rates far less than the Fegley program. Isn't it time you considered WEPA for your family's life insurance needs? For better insurance, better prices, and better value, visit WAEPA.org. That's WAEPA.org.
Attention all federal and military agencies. In March, the Australian Defense Force saved more than $150 million by using Intelsat General to put critical communications into space as a hosted payload on one of our satellites, on time and on budget. Our next hosted payload satellite launches in 2013. So if your agency needs on-time, on-budget access to space, take an example from our allies down under and look no further than Intelsat General. Learn more at spacedelivered.com. Intelsat General Hosted Payload Program. That's spacedelivered.com.
CPR training. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Nicholas Garlow with HHS HealthBeat. It can happen anywhere. Someone suddenly falls into cardiac arrest. CPR training prepares you to step in and possibly save someone. You should be trained every 2 years. It's one class that teaches you how to recognize a life-threatening emergency, use a defibrillator, and relieve choking in a safe and timely way. Sandra Dantzler is a nurse coordinator for FedStrive at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Are they responsive? If not, someone needs to call 911. When that's under control, you come back to the person and you start compressions. And if that's all you do, you're going to help save their life.
Cardiac arrest can occur as a result of heart failure, electronic shock, or drowning. You can learn more about CPR training from the American Heart Association and the Red Cross. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Nicholas Garlow.
Learn to navigate through tough IT, budget, acquisition, and leadership challenges. Meet other senior leaders from government and industry at the 2012 Executive Leadership Conference. Hosted by the American Council for Technology and Industry Advisory Council, this year's program covers mobility, big data, workforce empowerment, and government optimization. Join them October 28th through 30th in Williamsburg. Register now at actgov.org/ELC2012. That's actgov.org/ELC2012.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Every Friday in the 3 o'clock hour, we count down the three most important federal news stories of the week on the Federal News Countdown. Two people who are experts in the world of the federal government choose their stories, rank them in order from number 3 to number 1, and we count them down in the program. This week, the experts are Alan Shvatkin of the Professional Services Council and Bob Suda of Suda & Associates. And Bob, your second most important federal news story of the week is from Federal Computer Week. The headline is, "The Long-Awaited Retirement Tsunami Has Begun." And it includes some numbers from the Office of Personnel Management, observations from Tim McManus of the Partnership for Public Service, who's going to be on the program less than an hour from now to talk about the political appointee process and the issues that are involved there. But the amount of people who are high-level executives in government with lots of experience and lots of understanding about where the bodies are buried and how to get things done, they're leaving at a faster rate than the agencies are able to replace them or elevate people who are already in the ranks and move up. What do you see when you look at these numbers, Bob?
Well, again, I look at the numbers from a perspective of, I don't know how many of these are senior people at the 60,000, but I'm sure it's a lot of those people at the grade 13s and above. The challenge is bringing people on board. We have a lot of new folks coming on. I mean, it's harder to hire new people coming on. It's got to get them all trained, got to get them educated, got to get them knowledgeable how the government works. So I think we have a major brain drain here going on that's going to hurt us for a couple years moving forward, especially in the IT and accounting profession where I come from. So I see those two areas more so than anyplace else that may be an issue for us. But you got to remember, though, I mean, in 1984 is when the first program came in place. So the retirement system before that was the old CSRS system, and now it's FERS. So the CSRS people, these are the ones that are retiring right now because they have 30 years in. They don't see any potential bonuses or pay raises or anything for the next several years. So when you do the number crunching, you figure, why stay around? I can go on the outside, work for a contractor, you know, keep my retirement, and plus make some money on the outside doing something else.
Get your health benefits locked in.
Health benefits locked in, all that's locked in. The other part you mentioned is the knowledge base now of bringing those new people on board quickly. We got to figure out a way to keep those people engaged and trained and knowledgeable of federal regulations and legislation. Because if you have new people coming on board, they want to do their thing as they do their thing. So, but I remember coming on board back in 1977. You know, I had all these brain ideas and great ideas I wanted to put in place. I said, well, you can't do that because this regulation won't allow it. So as you start thinking, you got to remember that these people have to be trained also in regulations, the basic ones, not the ones that, you know, can get you – that don't get you in trouble. The basic ones that get you in trouble are the ones you have to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Alan, the idea that Bob talked about, which is folks are going to leave – how do we capture the knowledge that they have and transfer? How do we archive it? That seems to be more on the minds of the HR people at agencies that I talk to than the actual idea of people leaving. And I think that's maybe because we've been preparing for this so-called tsunami for seems like a decade. And now it's finally, as this story says, finally starting to happen. It's bearing itself out in the numbers.
Well, that's right. But they're not the right people to be if they're the only people focused on it, we're losing it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've got to capture knowledge. There's some very good knowledge management systems to help. There are other alternatives to do that. One point, though, for the listeners, Bob, typical comment, a lot of people in government who leave think that they'll go to work for contractors. I've got to tell you, the contractor community is cutting that back as
That's
well.
Correct. Yep.
There are salary restrictions. Mm-hmm. There are efficiencies. And so it's not like, you walk out the door today and some will be able to come back tomorrow. Many of them will not find that job in the contractor community. And in fact, the competition for talent that exists for government to attract new people in, they compete with the contractor community for that as well. And we collectively in the government space compete with the commercial marketplace, with the banks, with the electric utilities, with the Googles and the Amazons for those high-skill areas. So the federal government really needs to take a step back and look at what it can do to attract and retain the new workforce, the new skills that it needs. It may not be a one-for-one replacement. There may be other efficiencies. I don't think that kind of strategic human capital planning is taking place often enough or broadly enough.
One thing that I do see that is changing is the idea that the way to build the federal workforce is from the bottom up. For a long time, the perception seemed to be, well, if we have this many people leaving, we're going to bring in this many sevens and nines, and we'll just push everybody up a couple of notches. Agencies seem to be a lot more receptive right. to the idea of bringing people in at the executive level who don't have government experience necessarily, but who are willing to do whatever they is required of them to serve their country. That's a good sign,
well,
it seems to me.
You see a lot of people that are in the contracting community today are actually coming into government, which is really good. Right? They're coming as a branch chief, division directors, or experts in cybersecurity or in other areas. So you're seeing that translation from the private sector into the public sector.
What do you think is driving that from each side of that, for the employees who want to transition from the outside to government, and for the agencies who are being more receptive to hiring people from outside rather than really stuck on promoting from within?
Well, I'll take first of all, the government offers very attractive responsibility mm-hmm. at sooner and at much greater levels of responsibility. Look what we ask of military and the captains and lieutenant colonels. Enormous responsibility that you would never find in the private sector. Secondly, when the commercial marketplace tanked a little bit, the government was a very attractive employer of choice, primarily around healthcare. Mm-hmm. We saw a lot of people take those mid-career shifts, primarily to take advantage of that 5-year eligibility for healthcare. They're coming up on that end of that 5-year period as well,
That's
and
right.
so we may see some of those exiting. It's certainly not salary. It's certainly not benefits. So it is the opportunity to work on things that are uniquely government.
What do you think? What do you see when you look at that concept of?
Well, I think it's what Alan had just said. I think a lot of people in the private sector are saying, I want to be able to serve my country now. I've done what I had to do in the private sector. Right? I've done, you know, sales, BD, whatever it might be, or technical stuff that I want to now be able to do in the government. And as Alan said, the responsibility that government officials have is pretty high, and it's pretty important stuff. And I think the people in that have worked in those areas see the benefit of coming over and helping as an employee now versus a contractor.
Bob Suda's second most important federal news story of the week is from Federal Computer Week. The headline is, "The Long-Awaited Retirement Tsunami Has Begun," and you can find that story linked up now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The most important federal news stories of the week, number one, from Alan Shvatkin and from Bob Suda, when the Federal News Countdown continues on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Take command of your mobility initiative, a panel with experts from government and industry sponsored by Red River. And now, panelist Jeff Sessions, Senior Vice President of Corporate Strategy at Red River, on the role of the value-added reseller in mobility.
As value-added resellers, our job is really from a solution provider perspective to understand the needs of our customers and then marry that up with the technology of our manufacturing partners as well as the service capabilities of our systems integrator partners, put that in with our capabilities, and come up with some solutions. And many of the people on the panel we have helped in one form or function within their agencies.
What's your organization's mobility solution? As an authorized Cisco Gold partner, Red River can help you create a customized mobility kit with any kind of device, and they install any kind of software. Then wrap in complimentary 24/7 support, so you're on your way to working anywhere at any time. Learn more at redriver.com/mobility kit. IT decisions are black and white. Think red. Red River.
How effective or ineffective has the Obama administration been over the past 4 years? Federal News Radio examines 23 initiatives undertaken by the president, including hiring reform, cybersecurity, and small business contracting. Read our exclusive interview with OMB's Danny Werfel on reducing improper payments, and check out our interactive map of agency data centers. Plus, do green roofs really save money? See for yourself in our exclusive video, The Obama Impact, Evaluating the Last 4 Years, exclusively on federalnewsradio.com. Search Obama Impact.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop shop for government and military events worldwide. With hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.
Listen each week for Tech Tuesday on Federal News Radio. Every Tuesday, we zero in on how technology inspires innovation. Tuesday mornings at 11, it's Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, the latest on products that help bring policy to life. Then Tuesday afternoons at 12:30, join Federal News Radio's Jason Miller for Ask the CIO. Hear from the top of the food chain on how your agency is using technology today. Tech Tuesday, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by two people who are experts in the world of the federal government. This week, it's Bob Suda of Suda & Associates and Alan Schvatkin of the Professional Services Council, and we're up to...
Number one!
Now, gentlemen, the most important federal news story of the week, according to my friend David Olive, who's listening this afternoon, is that the Washington Nationals are in the playoffs. It's guaranteed they're locked in. Neither of you selected that, but Bob, your most important federal news story of the week is from Federal Computer Week. The headline is "The Mobile Revolution Could Transform the Next Generation Federal Workforce." I guess the only argument I would have with this article, which is very well written and very well researched, is the headline "could," because it seems to me it's already happening. I mentioned during the commercial break that it seems to me that the phrase "any device, anywhere, anytime" is starting to rival "do more with less" as one of the most overused phrases in government right now.
No, I agree. I mean, the reason I picked this story is that, again, same word, could, right? The whole issue about privacy, the whole issues that can come up, if something really happens with all these devices that are out there, and if you're teleworking or you're using an iPhone to do your work, and somebody gets into the system, gets into the network, right? And you have to wind up going to the Hill and deal with the Hill issue. I've done that, you know, several years ago at USDA. It was just because of one person, right? So the challenge you have is, will it stop if there are all of a sudden Hill issues where you're going up and testifying because somebody had their system hacked, like passwords or whatever, VA, who, you know, whatever the case might be? Then how's it going to slow it down, or is it going to stop it? I think this is all great stuff going on. I mean, again, you saw where GSA has to reduce square footage of space, you know, over the next 4 or 5 years. This is the way of doing it. All about telework, all about mobile. You can sit in a Starbucks and do your work if you had to. The question is, again, back to security, you know, using the mobile devices to do that. And a majority of people can use that because they're using it for email, PowerPoint, you know, the basic stuff. But if you're into an accounting system or if you're into an IT system, then where is the risk management on all that?
The first person that I heard talk about this issue in government was Jerry Davis when he was at NASA. He's now at the Department of Veterans Affairs. Mm-hmm. And I always give him credit, but with the caveat that he's the first person I heard talk about securing the data rather than securing the devices.
That's right.
And at the time that he first started to talk about that, he was, to my knowledge, unique in government. And now it seems like a lot of people have followed that concept, and that's where pretty much everybody is headed nowadays, is that to try to secure every device is just – it's not doable, especially in an era where we're going to be inviting people to bring their own, and all of these things are going to have access to all of this data.
And the devices change so quickly. I mean, nobody was prepared for – I don't know what agencies prepared for an iPhone 5, but the devices change, the applications change all the time, and they're not created with the idea of security. So another example of where we've built rules to prevent – the mistake from happening, and that ends up being a substantial barrier to activity. Yet the new millennials that are coming into work, they don't know sitting at computer screens. Everything is done in different devices around the clock. So we've got to be able to adapt, and that means some greater flexibility, a little bit more risk-taking, and we're still not over the HR management or the risk of error.
To your first comment, it wouldn't matter in the scenario that most agencies are headed for, it seems. It wouldn't matter when a new iPhone comes out or whatever, because the device is irrelevant. You know, one thing I hear CIOs say over and over again is device agnostic, device agnostic. We want to make sure anybody, as I said, any device, any time, et cetera, et cetera. The other thing that you said, Alan, that I think is particularly interesting is the idea of just trying to wrap the security around everything. The risk mitigation part of it I'm starting to see people talking about establishing priorities. And Bob mentioned folks are a lot of folks are using just doing emails and constructing slide decks and so forth. And does that data need to be secured in the same way or maybe even in a cloud environment, the same place that my financial management spreadsheets go to or not? That prioritization is something that agencies seem to be getting better
at. They are. And DOT, for example, Tim Schmidt over there has been doing that. He's been taking that risk management approach to these kind of devices. So he's looking at what kind of databases he has sitting and what they're actually providing as far as information is concerned and saying what's the risk around this of doing this. So that's what they're picking and choosing of what they can bring to the mobile devices to be used for.
Mm-hmm. I've told this story a number of times. I was at the FC at Bethesda Breakfast. My colleague Tom Temin was moderating it when Vivek Kundra first said, we're going to talk about letting employees bring their own devices to work. And I looked around, and the vendors in the crowd were drooling, and the IT people from inside agencies were just white. All the blood had drained out of their faces at the concept that they were going to be responsible for some Wild West scenario that they didn't really seem to feel prepared for. That's probably a year and a half or 2 years ago now. Is it fair to say that agencies are equipped to do this? Are they ready to handle any device, anytime, at least with plans in place, if they're not ready to actually put the devices on the networks yet?
I think they're trying to do that. I'm not sure if the plans are in place to make it all happen yet. I mean, I've talked to a number of CIOs where they want to move in that direction. Just a matter of how do I determine what my risk is. That's the key to this whole thing.
And are they connecting it as effectively as maybe they could to being an HR initiative where you can make your agency more attractive as a place to work if somebody can come into this environment? This story talks about Jerry Buchholz, the Assistant Administrator for Human Capital Management at NASA, and they're portraying it as an HR tool. Mm-hmm. Hey, come to work for us, and you get the advantage of doing business in this way. Some agencies seem to be doing that, but I wonder what we see across government as a whole.
I'm just a sort of government contracts lawyer, not a technology guy, but I see this manifest in the contracting rules, the efforts at shifting liability onto the contractors to make sure that the data is protected, to make sure that there's never another breach as occurred with the VA or any of the other breaches that have taken place. And so here again, I think we talked about FSMA earlier. I don't think the federal regulations, the contracting regulations, have kept pace with it, and I don't think they ever could. So we've got to look at them to make sure that if we move from protecting the device to protecting the data, that we have the ability to do that. And I'll go right back to my cyber question and everything else. They all come back to developing a set of standards and let the technology manage itself, at least from a contract side.
One last point before we have to take a break, Bob. Alan said that the regulations are set up to prevent that contractors are held responsible to the standard of making sure that there's never another breach. I'm starting to see a little bit more realization in the CIO community that that's not a sensible approach.
We all realize
it's
going to
happen,
right?
And what do you do? We're back to risk management again.
That's right. That's what it comes back to, is the risk management process. And as Alan had said, I think the contractors may have responsibility, but I also think that we have to write the policy or regulations today so that they're so flexible that we can move forward and not 10 years from now have to rewrite them again.
That's the trick, right? And that's the part of it I think that people are apprehensive about,
yep.
Bob. Bob Suda's most important federal news story of the week is from Federal Computer Week. The mobile revolution could transform the next generation federal workforce. It's linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And Alan Shpotkin's most important federal news story of the week. We'll wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown in just a moment.
Ask the CIO is brought to you by CenturyLink.
Lieutenant General Michael Basla is the Air Force's Chief Information Officer. He says his office is developing a technical implementation and an objective baseline for the rest of the service.
And then once that's completed and we're doing these things kind of in parallel, it will be delivered to the acquirers, to those functionals that have to operate their systems. And they will know the environment in which their capabilities will exist.
Ask the CIO Thursday mornings at 10:30 right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
This audio puzzle is brought to you by CenturyLink Government.
Let's see, growing digital needs go here. So many different applications over here. So where does IT budget stretch to the limit go?
Fortunately, CenturyLink Government has an answer with its vast portfolio of cloud services so customers get the right mix of performance and features. CenturyLink, solutions that work, service you can count on.
For a free risk assessment, visit CenturyLink.com/federal.
Life is long and filled with challenges. Navigating these can be difficult, but it doesn't have to be. Hi, this is Lisa Millman from AFMA. For over 133 years, AFMA has been leading military personnel through difficult times to a more secure future by offering the right products and services at the right time for the best price. Our low-cost life insurance and personal approach allow us to help you plan wisely and feel comfortable that your family will be taken care of. Our unparalleled survivor assistance services will allow your family to take a deep breath and relax knowing we'll take care of everything. When you choose AFMA, you choose a partner who will provide guidance, simple solutions, and personalized care. Our life insurance policies are available to all members of the Army, Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard. For a free life insurance quote, call a membership coordinator at 1-877-398-2263 or find us online at AFMA.com today. That's AAFMAA.com.
Skype connections are encrypted from end to end. The problem that some people are having is that Microsoft recently bought Skype. And Microsoft has been implementing some architectural changes to Skype. And now people are thinking that Microsoft or perhaps Skype itself has the ability to intercept phone conversations on their own servers. In other words, they could set up a man-in-the-middle attack from their servers.
Stay up to date with technology. It's Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
I'm on a mission to spread the word about COPD through music. COPD stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. My grandfather suffered from symptoms of it, and COPD is the fourth leading cause of death in the U.S. I'm Billy Ray Cyrus, and I drive for COPD. Looks like people are starting to get the message. Anyone age 35 and older who has smoked as little as 100 cigarettes could be at risk. Visit driveforcopd.com today and talk to your doctor.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The most important federal news story of the week is what you're hearing now on the Federal News Countdown. And Alan Shvatkin's choice for the most important federal news story of the week is from Politico. The headline is Senate Conservatives May Block Sequester Solution. And to be fair, I respect your selection of this story, Alan, but there had to have been 86,000 stories this week and in weeks prior that had to do with what might happen because of sequestration. And what really is fascinating to me and probably driving some people crazy is now we're starting to see all kinds of wrinkles in the sequestration story that we haven't seen up until now.
I think that's right, and that's why I picked it. Well, everybody has talked about we have to do away with it. We can't stand it. Well, it'll never work. And here we have a number of United States senators who are saying, well, maybe it's not so bad. Maybe from our objective, which is spending reductions, can be achieved, maybe not the exact same way, but before we just throw out the whole idea, it has some merit. A real counter flow from what everybody else has been saying and everything else reported. And so the idea that this is just don't worry about it, it's going away, not a problem, somebody else will fix it, I'm not so sure. We've been skeptical throughout the association and in our communications and conversations with our members. Companies have to plan, even if the government refuses to plan or is unwilling to plan.
Now, we talked about this, all three of us, before we went on the air. And, Alan, you staked out that ground when we were talking about it in outside the studio here. But, Bob, the reason that I might disagree with my friend Alan here is because of those wrinkles that I was talking about earlier and all of the things that people are saying could happen. Well, this might happen. I had Congressman Van Hollen on the show last week, and he talked about, well, maybe we'll do something in the lame duck that will delay it by 2 months. Now, nobody wants that to happen.
Right.
The ideal would be something to fix this and make it go away immediately. But just the fact that that is on the table is something that says to me, maybe I can be a little more optimistic than Alan.
Well, I agree. I think there's got to be some compromise. Some, you know, I think that the approach they were taking for the last year has sort of been standoffish. You got an election coming up in less than a month. Right? So everybody's starting to play the gamesmanship process. I mean, there are better ways probably to do sequestration and, you know, smarter ways to do it than just, you know, $100 billion across the board, basically. I think they need to look at those very carefully. But, again, it's all about this next month of getting ready for the election. I think once we get through the election, they're going to have to do something because they know, especially on the DOD side, you got people in Afghanistan who don't have supplies like they had 2 years ago. So, because they were drawn down on war. But the soldiers over there are still fighting. They're still being beat up every day. And we're not taking care of those guys. And we're going to now hurt them even more come January 2nd. Somebody's got to take a stand.
I was going to close this segment by asking you, sequester, yes or no. You've already given me your answer. And you have, too, to another degree, to some degree. So I guess we'll just wrap this up by, Bob, I'll start with you. When we look on the landscape of sequestration, if it does happen, and I know you don't believe it will, but if it does, the things that I'm starting to hear now also are we're going to be able to exempt some things. We're going to be able to move money around a little bit more than it looked like we were going to 2 months ago or 6 months ago. Will this be as bad as people are making it out to be?
Well, again, I don't think it's going to be as bad. I mean, it's not going to be $100 billion. It's going to be, if they do, it'll be something less than that. They'll find some accounting way of handling a lot of these things.
I'll just let you say it rather than put words in your mouth.
I've anticipated that we're going to have what I've termed a soft sequestration. That is, it will go into effect. The pain of the actual sequestration is what it's going to take in order to find the change. I don't see how the politics in a post-election are substantially different from they are than they are right now.
Gentlemen, it's always great to have both of you on the Federal News Countdown. I really appreciate your time. Alan, great to see you as always. Bob Suda, thank you very much for coming in. Alan Shvatkin's choice for the most important federal news story of the week is from Politico. Senate conservatives may block sequester solution. All the stories we counted down today are posted now on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And the second hour of In-Depth with Francis Rose is coming next on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.